seminar for September the 10th, 2010. And the title is Common Logic, Open Ontology Repository, and Sharing and Integrating Ontologies. My name is John Soa, and the speakers for today are John Bateman, Phil Mosakowski, Michael Grinninger, Cameron Ross, Adam Pease, and if he can make it, Pat Hayes. Second slide, slide two of my presentation, surveys the point about a family of logic. That first-order logic is a subset or a superset of almost every logic-based notation that is in use for knowledge representation. And for the more informal notations, such as frames and other informal things, first-order logic can represent them. In fact, it will make them more precise, although what is said so precisely might not be exactly what was intended. However, people are constantly inventing new notations, and very few people ever want to adopt somebody else's favorite syntax. So that the ISO-IEC standard for common logic defines a very general semantic foundation for an open-ended family of dialects. We started with some of the most common languages that were in use in artificial intelligence. There was the KIT dialect, which was the knowledge interchange format by Michael Genezareth, and what he tried to do was to subsume most of the other things that were available. I was developing conceptual drafts, which I coordinated with Genezareth, and now for the ISO standard, we have a very general dialect of logic, which subsumes the common logic interchange format, the conceptual graph interchange format, and an XML-based notation for the same semantics. But the point we've been emphasizing is that this family subsumes almost everything else that is widely used for knowledge representation. On slide three, it shows at the top human interfaces where we have controlled natural languages such as stylized versions of English, Chinese, or Spanish. On the right, we have various diagrams, such as UML diagrams, concept maps, topic maps, and various hybrid notations that combine language with diagrams, such as FLIP. At the bottom, we see the various machine-oriented languages, such as RDF, RDFS, OWL, Prolog, RuleML, Datalog, Object Constraint Language, Structured Query Language. All of those can be expressed within the common logic notations, and the ISO standard defines three dialects that are capable of supporting the full semantics. The CGIF, Conceptual Graph Interchange Format, CLIP, Common Logic Interchange Format, and an XML-based version called XCL. Now on slide four, I summarize the various issues involved in the project for sharing and integrating ontologies. And SIO is a project that is started as a community project by Ontolog Forum, hosted by Peter Yim. And SIO is a companion to the Open Ontology Repository. That we need more than just a repository for storing ontologies. We also need tools that can operate on those ontologies, transform the ontologies, merge ontologies, combine ontologies, analyze ontologies, and revise ontologies. And that is the point of the current talks today, is to show a series of tools which have been proposed and which are under development and being proposed as the tools that can support the sharing and integrating ontologies project for the Open Ontology Repository. So what I'll do today is just briefly mention the various speakers who will be talking today, and then you can I'll let them describe in more detail exactly what they're doing. But before going into that, I want to mention on slide five a very sharp distinction between ontologies, terminologies, and lexical resources. An ontology, as a field, is a study of what exists and how it can be formally described and axiomatized. And an ontology is a representation in some version of logic of the of what somebody decided is their pet theory about how to represent what exists in their domain of interest. Now, the point about an ontology is that it is formal. It's processed in logic, and it is most definitely not a system of natural language words. A terminology is a classification of the technical terms used in any branch of science, and those words must be represented in the an ontology that is going to be used for reasoning about that field. But the point is that the terms in your ontology are much sharper and more precise than the informal terms in your terminology. Now, a lexical resource is a dictionary or something that's designed for human consumption, including thesaurus, grammar, and it represents the vocabulary, syntax, or semantics of some natural language. A very widely used example is WordNet, which the developers, George Miller and Christian Fellbaum, definitely do not call an ontology. It is not an ontology, and to call it an ontology confuses the issues. So WordNet is a valuable lexical resource, but if you align two ontologies to WordNet, that does not guarantee that the corresponding categories in those ontologies have equivalent definitions. And merging and relating ontologies requires tools based on logic. So the tools that are being developed today, that are being discussed today, include, first of all, there's the work by the Brayman Ontology Research Group, and there are two speakers, John Bateman, who's the project leader, and Till Mazakowski, who is another of the major developers of the various tools. They will present their tools and how they work together and what they do. The next project that will be discussed is the CALORE project, which stands for Common Logic Ontology Repository. And the project leader is Michael Gruninger from the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering at the University of Toronto. And the CALORE project is being coordinated with the work that is being done at Brayman so that it will be eventually possible to merge all of these tools and have them all working together. The fourth speaker of the day is Cameron Ross, who will talk from Cogeware, and he will talk about the Samian platform architecture. And as you can see in slide 8 in my slide, it shows that there are a variety of different tools that are being developed for this platform. Now, the CLISP translator, a TPTP, the TPTP stands for thousands of programs for theorem, thousands of problems for theorem provers, and that is a website, tpt.org, which has thousands of problems that various people have been processing with their theorem provers, and there is a variety of tools that have been developed for TPTP. That's also being incorporated. SUOKIP is an earlier version that has now been updated to form CLIP, and they have a translator to SUOKIP, and they plan to have translators to a variety of other languages as well. And Cameron Ross will talk about that. And then the third speaker of the day, or the fifth speaker of the day, is Adam Pease, who will talk about the Sigma architecture and the Sigma knowledge engineering environment. And there is a diagram on my slide number 9, which shows the various components that Adam will be discussing. So with that introduction, let me begin with the first speaker, John Bateman from Brayman.
Right, then I'll get started. Thank you, John Sowa. We are building on more or less everything that John Sowa says, so we'll take all of that for granted, particularly with the need to have formal ontology. And so we have been working for a while now on formal ontologies based upon logic of various kinds. So if we have the next slide, please. Over a number of presentations in this community and Ontolog and others, I and Phil and others have talked about a variety of projects where we've been using ontology, and one of our central orientations there is the need for heterogeneity. And there I'll build on what John Silver said, saying that everybody, well, people are very loath to take other people's syntaxes. We take that a step further and apply it to this as well. So we have heterogeneity not only in notations, but also in the kinds of logic that are supported. And today we'll be talking about how common logic fits within that broader scheme. So the formal and computational tools that we use, which we've also mentioned before in talks in the past, are the common algebraic specification language and have the heterogeneous toolset, and we'll be seeing more of all of these things later on today. So the next couple of slides are going to be bringing us up to date and saying some of the things which we've seen before in these kinds of discussions, just so that everybody is on the same page, which is slide 3 for the current process. Slide 3. So the choice that we've made for formalizing ontologies, and we'll be doing this now for using CARTL for the last 6-7 years for ontology work, the language itself is described there where it comes from on slide 3. It's developed in the Common Framework Initiative for Algebraic Specification Development, being on joint since 1995. So Mosakowski, who will be taking over the talk later on, has been centrally involved at all stages in that and is now the main person developing this. And it is a de facto approved standard in the ICIS Working Group Foundation for System Specification. The most important part from my perspective, for an ontologist, is the last part there in bold, that this language provides structured specification. And for our work on heterogeneity and bringing together various different kinds of ontologies, this seems to me to be a crucial component that we would not want to be without. Next slide, please. So the heterogeneous toolset, which is where our main focus will be today, is a multi-logic parsing analysis and proof tool, and some of the logics which we include in its capabilities currently are propositional logic, OWL, first-order logic, and also higher-order logic. And you can see on the overhead there that there is also linking with reasoners of various kinds, theorem provers, and one of the main capabilities of HES is to provide a modular interface to such a wide variety of theorem provers. Next slide. So we have here the standard architecture slide for HES, where you can see in the middle a graph indicating some of the logics which are supported. And down the right-hand side, you see that one of the things that makes this all work is that it's based upon institution theory, so that there's a very general view of what logic is and what logics are, and this enables new logics to be added into the framework with a relative ease. You have the next click, please. And as I said before, one of the main reasons, the main additions for ontology building and also for formal specifications in general is the fact that we can have these structuring mechanisms that we'll see here. And here we have the extension of CARTL, HES CARTL, so heterogeneous CARTL. In some of the examples that we use later on, you'll see heterogeneous specification in action. Next slide, please. And, of course, HES is freely available from the web address on this slide. So those of you who want to run with us and get the demo up, you've got 5 minutes, so through it. Otherwise, we'll walk you through it. Next slide, please. We can go through the slides, but then you won't have the demo.
Yeah, we have one slide about the video, so I can tell you about when looking at the slide, I can tell you about the video, and then those people having the video can in parallel look at the video.
Okay, sure. Good. Which slide should we be on? 7?
Keep going, go to 7. Maybe when while we're doing this, before we get to it, when people can also try to download the video, and we could have a quick show of hands if the problem is more widespread, then we could have an idea.
Okay.
So getting back to the talk part here, then what you will see in the video, and maybe it will come up in some of the slides later, is one of the main ways we have of looking at and interacting with the specifications that we have when we define theories using it's in Castle and Head Castle, and that is a development graph. And each of those little green circles you can see there is a specification. And the links between the nodes are indicating when queries are being imported, when there are proof obligations of various kinds, and these also have various properties which one can navigate around, and also set things like checking proof obligations in action. Also with these nodes, then there is no requirement that these have to be drawn from the same logic. So because of the basis in institution theory and how HEDS is set up, then we can really have heterogeneous structuring of theories. So we have here a sort of a combination of the lattice of theories that John Sowa has talked about for a long time. We have here a lattice, and also within the individual nodes, we have the possibility of having contributions from different logic. Next slide, please. So this is a flashback to March this year, of the last talk we gave at Ontolog, and we have here the further step slide, which I was ending with, where we said we already added our DL to the family of logic supported by HEDS, and we are exploring combining the structuring principles of parcel and description logic. And since this will be used in the example in the video, if anybody can see the video, then I'll just say something about the first 2 points and then come to the last 2 points afterwards. Next slide, please. So we have this process of adding new logic into the logic covered by HEDS. And the one which we reported back in March was the addition of the RDL to the kind of specifications which can be supported with HEDS. And offhand, you have some translation. Is this a PowerPoint or something else? You've got a translation problem with the overhead here, sorry. Never mind. But I'll hand over to Till here to walk us through the specifications and lead us to the additions we've now made to for common logic.
Yeah, so here at the right-hand side is the small OWL theory in the Manchester syntax. We have the class female, person, and mother, and some statement saying that the mother is a person having some child, a female having some child, but it's a person. And then we have the head structuring around that is logic OWL, and then you specify the logic you want to use, and you get a certain name to the specification. Instead, you could here also download just a normal OWL file without the S-child syntax. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we are in the process of adding common logic at the HEDS logic node. And the advantage is that you can immediately inherit all the proof support that is already there. Next slide, please. Yeah, so here you have related ontology, also both mother, female, person, and so on, but written in the common logic syntax. Again, around that you have this extra syntax from HEDS. Again, you could also directly read in, say, TLIF files here and import them, and then use the heterogeneous structuring. So HEDS can directly parse these files. Next slide, please. So, for example, we have taken the Colora repository and read in the files there into HEDS, although some of them didn't work, but recently there was a new version and then many more files worked. And then we have a translation from Common Logic basically also into the TPT format that already has been mentioned, and via this CPTP you can access the films like Stark, Vampire, Darwin, and Master. We also interface fast with the more complex DFG format, so you have also specific features of the provers captured. We also have the theorem prover Igarbell, which is a higher order prover available for proof. For example, it might be because Common Logic can speak about lists and do recursion on lists. You might need, in some exceptional cases, to do some injection on lists, which is not available in the first autocorrector, so you could do CWS for that. We also have the translation from Marble into Common Logic, and then we can basically, with Headcastle, provide heterogeneous structuring and refinement. For example, it's quite common that you have, say, a first-order version of your ontology and an null version. For example, Dolce has that. There's the first-order Dolce, and then there's Dolce Lite, which is an null version. And then you might ask the question, how are these two ontologies logically related? And in Headcastle, you can express this with a view. The view expresses a refinement in specification, or in logical speak, it's an interpretation of theory or a logical entailment between theories, if you wish. And for example, here we could express a view going from family OWL to family TL. And basically, the adoption of the logic is done behind the scenes because there is a standard encoding. And this expresses that the theory family TL, written in Common Logic, logically implies the theory family OWL written in OWL, but not necessarily vice versa. So if you want to have the converse relation, you have to write something else. Okay, next slide, please. So that's now the demo. Yeah, those of you being able to watch the video, you could just watch it. I just explain what's going on there. So what you can do with it is, as I said, you can parse a Common Logic file. You can also show the vocabulary that is used in a file. Although Common Logic is signature-free, sometimes it's useful to have the vocabulary. Of course, the quantified variables are not in there, just the, say, the three symbols. You can, on the fly, enter proof codes there. For example, in the ontology we just have seen, you could try to prove that Carol is a mother, but then you see that the proof will fail. And this is because we need some extra theorem, an extra axiom, namely that Peter is a person. Aha! So Cameron just had put the video onto YouTube. Peter, perhaps you can play it from there.
Can you share that with the DNC, Peter?
Yes. Hang on, just one moment. I can show it on the VNC, but I doubt if it will transmit that fast. People would probably do better if they go to the YouTube site. However, I would suggest maybe till that you try to sync everyone up and let everyone stay at the zero time mark, and then you tell everyone to start in sync. Well, we can all sort of stay on zero.
Okay. So then please set all on zero. And then you, if you are on YouTube, you can also click at the full screen button.
Yes, okay,
so
I have done that.
It's at the lower right corner of the video. So now everyone is ready to watch the video.
So everybody gets to zero, and we'll count you down, and then...
Okay.
Start. Okay.
Okay. So, 3, 2, 1, 0. Start. So, you see at the video here in Emacs with the specification I just have shown you. Now I call test and get a graph with the two nodes corresponding to the two theories in Common Logic and OWL. I can show the theory. And now I want to prove something. I enter the proof code there. Namely, you won't see it on the video, it's small, but it's Carol is the mother, and I write a per sentence slide there in order to say it's a theorem and not an axiom. I call the prover interface and select the prover and say prove. So I actually have selected start, and start tries to prove that, but there is a timeout, so within 10 seconds, it couldn't be proved. And actually, the reason it cannot be proved is it's not possible to prove it, because if you look at the theory, in order to prove that Carol is a mother, there is a head child, Carol Peter, but you need that Peter actually is a person. So we now enter this missing sentence there, that Peter is a person, and add it to the theory, and prove it again. Here you see a selection of provers like Spark, Vampire, Darwin. You can select the prover. We select again Spark. Click on prove, and immediately we get it proved. And now if you look at the graph, the node turns into green, which means all proof obligations have been proved. Now I switch to a different theory, namely the duration theory from the Colore repository, and I get, again, a graph with just one node, and we're not supporting modules yet. Later I will say more about this, and I can browse this theory here. And here you see the vocabulary highlighted. Finally, we have... here, the logic graph of HEX, you see that we have about 20 logics there. Among them, OWL and Common Logic there, which is highlighted now. And then via sample, we have this translation to SoftPol, and SoftPol is Softly Typed Auto Logic. And here you see a list of provers, so and also consistency checkers available for this logic. But in a way, you can move around the graph in any way you like, and the blue nodes are the ones supported with provers, and you can use any of these. Now, finally, let's go back to the family theory. So recall that we have an OWL specification of this family stuff and a common logic one, and that's highlighting the OWL one, that's highlighting the common logic one, and now we see the view there, which expresses the refinement. In order to prove this refinement, we just call HEX again, I switch to the right window, now we call HEX, and now we actually get a proof obligation again in the common logic part, because we basically express that the common logic part logically implies the OWL part. We call the prover, prove this, and then you again see that the node gets green, which means all proof obligations have been done. Finally, we want to try to check the consistency of these ontologies. First, the OWL one. So there, for example, we can use Pellet or FACT++. And actually, Pellet finds that it is consistent. Now we try to check the consistency of the common logic ontology. We have Darwin there with a special flag that also infinite models are soft. But there is a timeout after 10 seconds, and even if you give more time, it won't find a model. And that's a problem of common logic, unlike other first order logic, basically, since these lists are included, models are basically infinite, and it's difficult for model finders to handle that. So could you go to the slide? I think it's slide number 10 or...
Did you say slide number 10?
No, it's 13, I think. 13.
Okay.
Now, next slide, please. Next slide, 14, actually. Yeah. Okay. So, the future word would be actually to use also the structure of common logic specifications. But first, the semantics of the module construct has to be agreed upon. There was a discussion on the common logic mailing list, which is, there's no conclusion yet. Actually, a compositional semantic, whatever it looks in detail, would be easier to implement because also has a compositional module system. We also want to add support for disproving so that you can actually disprove the theorem. We are basically nearly finished there. Next slide, please. Okay, so now the final slide. So future work will also link head to the on-block world, which means that we have then a web interface and a repository for specification with an database and our steering facility. And the linking this to the OOR world would be highly desirable because the questions concerning repositories and proving and so on are very similar. Yeah, thank you for your attention.
Thank you. That's it.
I'm sorry for the long time caused by the technical problems.
That was wonderful.
This is John Soh again. Okay, well, thank you very much for the presentation. That sounds like a lot of very interesting work. I just had one question that Till mentioned something about a problem with common logic. I wasn't clear about what exactly that problem was.
There was a discussion on the common logic mailing list in January 2010 between basically Fabian Neuhaus and
you mean
the consistency proof?
I don't know. You mentioned something that there was a problem that you couldn't do with common logic, and I just wanted to know what was that problem. Just the one you mentioned.
Yeah.
Just now.
It was model finding. So of course, if you write down an ontology, you want to know that it is consistent, that it has a model. And there are first order model finders, like Darwin or KR Hyper, and we have integrated them into HEC. So you can do model finding also. But the problem is that common logic has the list built into the syntax and semantics. And this means that there are no finite models, in a sense, because you always have a list in there. And maybe someone comes up with a nice encoding. So one could, of course, for theories that do not essentially use these lists, one could code out this, but we have not done this yet. So currently we use a very generic encoding, and then you always get the list, which means that the models are always infinite, and that's more difficult for the model finder.
Yeah. Well, one point I want to make is that common logic deliberately has a very, very general semantic that subsumes everything, or at least as much as possible. But that does not mean that everybody has to use the maximal semantics. That it is always possible to have. For any particular application, you can choose some subset of common logic. For example, RDF is a very trivial dialect of common logic. OWL is another dialect. All of these things are dialects so that you can mix and match whatever dialect you use and have choose the most general one applicable or necessary for your application, but not use the full one. So that the point is that you can indeed have signatures in common logic with the very strict constraints on what types of any relation are permitted. What you can have a very strictly hierarchy, a very strict limited disjoint sorts. All of those can be incorporated within the common logic framework so that you can choose whichever version is applicable to your application. So that's not really a problem with common logic, because you should view common logic as a common semantic framework for an open-ended variety of different logics, and you can choose to use whichever one is applicable or useful for your application.
Yes, so if you have these lists in your specification, if you don't use lists, which is in a sense difficult, but you could figure out, say, instead of using lists, you have an array, predicate, and so on, then it works. But if you use lists, like Sumo does, there is much use of lists on Sumo, for example, then you cannot use the normal consistency checkers. So that's just the lesson that we have learned. I agree that if you say in some logic that are simple, then it's easier.
Yes, a huge number of applications don't use that option. And so the point is that don't blame Common Logic for it, because it's just that Common Logic is a framework for an open-ended variety of different subsets, and you can choose whichever subset you need for your application. And for many, many applications, you really don't need that option.
That's right, John. That's very good to hear, because that's exactly the philosophy behind HES. Because, of course, that's where we have the tool support for having different logics with different capabilities, and that's what we've been using now for the past 6-7 years, because that's exactly one in the ontology work, that you only use the logic with the expositivity you require. And that's one of the motivations behind having this heterogeneous tool set with the heterogeneous specification. So, we need all those different capabilities and different expositivities, and we also need the tool set, and that's what we are using it for.
Yeah.
So, Mikhail, there's another point, though, that it's not something necessarily specific to Common Logic. I mean, there are many first-order theories, for example, the duration theory used there, which have only infinite models.
That's true,
So, I mean, that's the other issue.
Right, and the point is that we really, this is one area that we should definitely address, is the idea of having families of subsets, so that we really shouldn't focus on all these different languages, but rather on families of subsets of logic, and then say which version is the maximal one expressible in a given version of logic and a given notation. But within that framework, you can just pick whichever version is suitable for your application, and then all of the subsets can also be migrated into that one. That's something that we had discussed in great detail during the development of the Common Logic Standard. However, it wasn't put into the official standard, because it's not really something that has to be standardized, because it truly is open-ended. On the other hand, it definitely needs to be in some additional explanatory material about how to use the Common Logic Framework.
Yeah, I think it's valuable. If we have in CASL, we have a lattice of, 1,000 sublogics, which are produced in a systematic way by combining certain features. I would like to see something similar for Common Logic, not necessarily as an ISO standard, but just as a document where this is described, and the tool developers can actually build upon that.
Yes, we definitely need that. In any case, we are running out of time. And so thank you very much. Is Michael Grinninger, who will talk about the Calore system. Michael?
Okay, thanks, John. So I'm just going to go over a few just brief notes with respect to Calore, and a lot of this is as a prep with Cameron. I just wanted to also kind of distinguish a few points in the sense of I look at Calore as being a really primarily a ontology content project. The software kinds of functionality is sort of independent of many of these ideas, and to some extent we're kind of independent of whatever software functionality eventually it gets incorporated with. I mean, we're currently working with Cameron to supply some incorporate his Fabian platform tools with Calore to develop Calore as a software artifact. But I'd say for the most part, we're looking at Calore as being a content project. So if we move to slide two, all I'm going to be doing for these slides, it's just very brief. I just want to go over, in a sense, some of the objectives of the project. And so on slide two are some of the ontological engineering objectives. And really the primary objective is to use Calore as a testbed for different ontology integration and evaluation techniques. So specifying relationships between ontologies, such as John and Hill just demonstrated, as well as other techniques for ontology verification that we presented in our 4A 2010 paper. And similarly, as Till was discussing, using theorem provers and model construction software for ontology verification and semantic integration. So a lot of the same issues that Till demonstrated we've also been on slide three. The second sort of objective we have is a kind of a broader one, which is to support the design and reuse of modular ontologies. So this is one thing that in the CASL demonstration still missing is kind of the modular structure that is being exploited within Calore using modules and main text from common logic. But there still are different, you know, criteria for modularity. What makes up a particular module? What are some of the logical criteria here? What are some of the impediments to reusability? And so, I mean, this is, I guess, an overarching theme for a lot of the ontology repository work. I mean, we say that ontologies are meant to be, you know, reusable forms of knowledge, yet there is very little ontology reuse. And so what we want to do is to use Calore as a way of identifying what are these impediments. And to really start to say, you know, don't look at reuse after ontology design, but to really think of ontology design for reuse, kind of analogous to the software model. And so we really want to support and encourage the construction of ontologies by assembling and reusing existing modules. And so that's why that's one of our other sort of objectives here. Moving on to slide three, oops, sorry, slide four. So there are another set of issues. So beyond the kind of the generic ontological engineering issues, there's a lot of those issues I've just discussed and you can apply to any particular language. There are certain common logic specific objectives that we have within Calore. And the first is, how do we can develop techniques for representing ontologies using common logic? So how can we assist the user in writing axioms? Ali Hashemi in 2009 did some work on some ontology design assistance where people could provide models and use the repository to find the best match of a theory within the repository that satisfied the user's examples. But also other techniques for module and main text management within common logic. So again, the ability to do ontology design for reuse. So some of these tools, I mean, in some ways, I guess you'd say, you know, we're looking for, you know, an environment analogous to Protégé, but with the ability to assist users in writing axioms. In slide five, another objective is really to promote common logic, you know, the ISO name 24707, but to really promote common logic for constructing ontologies using first-order logic. And really there's a lack of substantial, robust common logic ontologies really for a wide range of generic and domain-specific concepts. I mean, there are a few examples like Sumo and PFL and the time ontology that Pat Hayes originally wrote in KIF. But kind of beyond that, there's really a lack. And so what we're trying to do within Calore is provide this content. And that's why I was saying before that we really emphasize Calore as being a kind of a content-oriented project, and we're really looking for the best software environment that we can exploit to provide that content. And kind of then, once we have these a library, a repository of these common logic ontologies, to really support then the needs for, well, how would we actually use these ontologies for a wide range of applications? Decision support, semantic integration, and search. So the idea being, in addition to a repository is more than just a library, what other kinds of features do we need to have here? On slide six, another objective is to really develop best practices for ontological engineering using Common Logic. That URL there is our Google code site for Calore, where we're just going to list a few of the best practices specific to CLIF. So how to employ modular design principles, avoiding unnamed texts, naming things with URNs, and Cameron's going to discuss a lot of these in more detail. And then on slide seven is what I mentioned earlier, right? So if, you know, from the OOR perspective, right, we want to establish an open repository of Common Logic ontologies. But the question really here is, you know, how is the repository more than just a library? You know, what's the role of reasoning services in the ontology repository? And so some of these ideas have come up in previous telecons, but we're really still, you know, moving towards a solution here. And so the idea is going to be, what are the additional kinds of functionalities that we would want to have? So I see some of the work that Ali Hashemi has done before is using the repository to find the best match of a repository theory with a set of models, how to automatically generate semantic mappings between different ontologies, and kind of using reasoning in doing search and retrieval. And then finally, we want to be able to have you know, additional Common Logic repositories and how we can ensure that you know, we can have a federated system of all these repositories, for example, you know, with Sumo and its Sigma environment. And then the final slide is supposed to be a transition here to Cameron's presentation. All right, so what's the necessary software functionality that we would want to have support the content of Calore? So we want to have services that, you know, different APIs and services for accessing the repository, kind of, you know, identifying services that are generic for any language, but focusing on services specific to Common Logic. We want to be able to support, you know, both web-based and non-web-based applications. Within our semantic technologies lab, most of our applications have been non-web-based. You know, but we want to kind of be able to exploit a lot of the web, other web-based kind of features. And then finally, and this is what Cameron will be focusing on, is how we can really enable and promote an ecosystem of all kinds of software artifacts that are focusing on Common Logic, things like editors, translators, reasoning engines, you know, both open source and commercial, in an integrated environment. And that's, you know, it really kind of does a lot of this in its context, but we kind of want to be able to make sure that this is like an open source kind of ecosystem that we can leverage on. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Are there any quick questions that related to this talk?
I tried to be brief so we can get on to some of the more discussion.
Okay, then let's go on to the next talk, which builds on this, and that's by Cameron Roth, who has been using the Calore and other tools and putting them together into a Famian environment, as he called it. Cameron, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, yes, as Michael mentioned, this presentation will build on somewhat on top of the objectives that he outlined in his presentation. So I'll be describing some development of an OOR implementation for Calore that we've been working on in recent months. Next slide, please. So I didn't want to go and rename another project, so I called all of this Calore system project. Essentially, it breaks out into two tracks. Whether or not we rename things later, we'll have to discuss. The project is a collaboration between that works on two streams of development. The first stream is related to content development. That's done by Michael's group at the Semantic Technologies Laboratory at the University of Toronto. And so Michael will be the custodian of the Calore content. And then there's the other stream that focuses on software development, which is being managed by Codeware Corporation. And so I'll be the custodian of the Calore software. Next slide, please. So So the Quarry system software we're developing is based on something called the Sandian platform. And at the center of the Sandian platform, it was really spawned from the Sandian translation framework. At the center of that is an object-oriented representation of the common logic abstract syntax model as defined within the standard, so something we call Clasm. And so this is an object-oriented model written in Java that provides full-level access to the sentence structure within a set of CL texts. Now, around this model, what we've done is provided a mechanism that separates the structure of the model from operations over that structure, and we use something called the visitor pattern, which is signified by the pink ring. The pattern allows us to implement arbitrary operations over the structure, which we can use for various things like translation or as inputs to reasoning engines, etc. So the translation framework essentially sets up a pipeline of processing elements. On the one end, the input end, we have a parser that can parse arbitrary texts in some representation. And that generates, using the Antler framework, something that's called an abstract syntax tree. So we have a source AST. And then through successive transformation steps, we can transform that source AST into a common logic representation. And the complexity of those transformation steps can be arbitrarily complex. We use something called the Antler Tree Walker mechanism to do that. Once it's in the CL AST form, we have a load module that can render the AST into the Clasm model, the common logic abstract syntax model. Once it's in this form, we've implemented a specific visitor on the visitor pattern interface that allows us to walk that model and emit textual representation based on a templating system. So by changing out different templates, we can retarget the output representation. Right now we have a set of templates for Cliff. So If we envision a pre-printer application, we would have a Cliff input parser, which we have, that can generate arbitrary or can parse arbitrary Cliff text. And through this processing pipeline can input that into the Clasm model. We then have the emitter that can walk that model and regenerate the Cliff representation. So you can think of a pre-printing application. So this is a general model of the translation framework in Sandian. Next slide, please. Now, we can use that for a variety of different things. For example, we have a Cliff translator that I just described for pre-printing. We also have a SuoKit translator, and the reason I chose SuoKit to develop a prototype of the translation framework is that SuoKit is very, very close to what the common logic semantics expects. So there wasn't a lot of work in terms of the transformation steps required, which allowed me to focus on the framework. So what we have there is we have a SuoKit parser that can parse input text and through transformations of tree walkers can input that text into a common logic abstract syntax representation within the Clasm. Then what we use is the Cliff backend, the Cliff emitter, to walk over that representation and generate the Cliff output text. So there's a few issues still remaining with the transformation process of this translator, but that's underway, and I should have that done in a week or so. So generally speaking, this allows us to consider other translators. For example, it should be fairly straightforward to create a CDIF translator and a CL-controlled English translator because they're both based on the same common logic semantics. A more complex translator might be OWL, where the intention there would be able to load up various OWL ontologies into this Clasm model. However, transformation steps involved would probably be a lot more complex because we'll have to generate mapping axioms and those sorts of things. Another thing I'm currently working on is a cycle translator. The objective there is to be able to generate a Cliff representation of the psych ontology as best as possible. And to load that up into the Clasm. This would allow people to write axioms and rules and common logic that hang off of the psych ontology. Another part of that would be to try to leverage the psych reasoning engines that we can access via OpenPsych And so we would implement a back-end emitter, a cycle emitter, that would be able to walk those, that model of those axioms that hang off the psych ontology and be able to input those into psych. As John mentioned in the introduction, a translator to the TPTP syntax is envisioned. So both ways, actually, so that we can load up the TPTP problem set into the CLASM and translate them into CLIF, and also to be able to integrate TPTP-based reasoners so that we can reason over common logic models in the CLASM. We can even envision just arbitrary algorithms operating over this model. So through the same visitor interface now, we can implement a different visitor that allows us to walk and ask questions, for example, given this CL main text, go out and calculate for me the transitive closure of all the importations within that text, those sorts of things. Ultimately, we'd like to see a reasoner developed that's tuned to common logic and that integrates or interfaces with the CLASM using this visitor pattern interface. So that's the translation aspect of it. Now, if we look above, I have this idea of a resource-oriented repository. A traditional repository is very oriented around things like source code files and high-level concepts like that, not really intended to get down into the low-level sentence structure of the CLASM, but it would allow people to, through a RESTful sort of approach, pull out resources such as name modules and those sorts of things, and service the requirements of a repository. Down on the lower level, we have the Data Nucleus Access Platform. Now, this is a technology that separates the concern of persistence from the Java model in the CLASM. And that allows us, through configuration scripts, to retarget what database system we're persisting the CLASM model within. So we can target things like Oracle and MySQL. We can even target non-relational databases, such as an object-oriented database or other systems like Google Bigtable, for example. So that's a very high-level summary of the Samian platform architecture. Next slide, please. So this slide puts the platform in the context of an open ontology repository for Plori. So what we're doing is we're going to deploy this within Google's cloud computing infrastructure, something called Google App Engine. And Google App Engine is a bit of a restricted environment, so the idea being if we can deploy it there, we can probably deploy it pretty much anywhere. We get some advantages by using Google App Engine. For example, the Data Nucleus Access Platform is already integrated with Google Bigtable, so we'll be able to persist out collections of CL texts within Google Bigtable, which is something that I'm fairly excited to get into. We also get the value of other Google services, for example, Google Users service. So we don't have to build out authentication infrastructure into the system. We can just write on top of what's there from Google. So people will be able to log on to the system using a Google account or another OpenID account. Now, web services is a fairly reasonable mechanism to expose the RESTful or the resource-oriented repository, and we're going to be reusing, we're going to be utilizing the RESTlet framework, which is what BioPortal uses to drive its RESTful web services, and they report that it works fairly well for them, and it is also integrated with Google App Engine. Now, the mapping between the web services layer and the resource-oriented repository layer should be very direct because it's the same level of abstraction. And of course, we have to deploy this somehow, so we're going to use the Spring framework container within a Java server container, very similar to how BioPortal does it. And all of this is stuff that's known to work within Google App Engine. So that's a high level of the Plori system architecture. Next slide, please. Just want to talk a little bit more about the programmatic interfaces to the Samian platform. There's two. One is the object-oriented interface, which is based on this visitor design pattern I mentioned. Again, it separates structure from operations over the structure. The structure won't change much. It's derived from an ISO standard, so even with some modifications over time, that's not a big deal. It's fairly stable. Operations, on the other hand, we want to support a multitude of different operations, and this provides us an extensible framework to do that. Now, this interface is not intended to be used as a remote procedure call interface. The intention is that the services running on this, operating over this model, are fairly close to the model. That is, they are running in the same computer process as the model. So it's used by operations that require intimate knowledge of the CL text getting down into the sentence structure. On the other hand, we have the resource-oriented interface, which it uses or employs the representational state transfer principles. I won't go through them there. There's four of them. Long and short of it is that it's used to manage things from a resource-level perspective, adding new texts, updating texts, those sort of things. And it is intended to be a remote procedure call interface. Next slide, please. So what we've been considering lately is this idea of a common logic resource model. And we're not talking about user resources and administrators and those sorts of things. We're specifically talking here about resources within common logic text itself. And we're going under the premise here that the resources that make sense from a repository perspective include main texts, modules, and interpretable names. And that's sort of where our thinking is right now. So once we've identified these resources, we'll want to name them. And ideally, we'd like our names to be globally unique. We'd like those names not to change over time so that people who refer to them don't have to go back and modify their files. And importantly, we'd like them to be location independent. As Michael pointed out, we're not just targeting semantic web applications. We're targeting a much broader scope. And we don't want to use URLs where something is tied to a specific machine under some specific control. If you look at the various mechanisms that have been developed over time to support that, you're going to end up down with coming across universal resource names, which are a type of URI. And so the thinking is that we would register a namespace ID with the IANA, something like OOR. And then an initiative like the OOR initiative or a foundation in the future would manage that namespace. So, for example, Calore, Michael's work on the Calore content, would approach OOR and say, hey, we want to register for the Calore sub-namespace. And then the Calore project would be responsible for managing the sub-namespace below it. So if we look at the PSL core module, it would have a name text value as I've stated in the slide here, the URN OOR label. Interpretable name within the PSL core, for example, the before relation, would have all of that prefixed on it. So this would give us our goals of global uniqueness, persistibility, and location independence. But there's a few concerns. One is the names are verbose, but we maybe can get tooling to help us with that. Also, URN resolution, the Internet Engineering Task Force, has some RFCs that talk about this, but it's not a widely deployed system. So there are ways of dealing with this. We just need to consider them, give a little more thought to that. Next slide, please. So a little bit on the coordinates of projects. There's two projects. There's the Calore initiative, which is a Google code project. So there's a subversion repository, a wiki, discussion list, issue tracker, those sorts of things. It's currently released under the Creative Commons license with attribution and share alike. However, based on yesterday's conversation, I'm thinking maybe that should be changed to just with attribution. That's something that we'll have to reflect over the next couple of weeks with the IPR sessions that are underway. There's currently about 159 CLIF files in the Calore subversion repository. So there is a sizable amount of content there. The Samian project is an Eclipse Labs project. Now, Eclipse Labs is essentially a rebranding of Google Code. But what it does is it tracks projects in that will become fully-fledged projects under the auspice of the Eclipse Foundation. And that's what we intend or hope for the Samian platform to become. It has all the same tools as a Google Code project, which is good for managing it. The code there will be released under the Eclipse public license version 1.0, so it's amiable to both commercial and non-commercial use. Right now, in the repository, we have the CLIF translators, so that's the parsers and transformation components and the emitter stuff. We have the common logic abstract syntax model written in Java. These things are heavily unit tested and fairly well designed. I'm in the process now of sanitizing my SQLKit translator, and I'll be posting that up there in a week or two. Next slide, please. So the point there is that it's real software. It's not all vaporware. We currently can do some work with this stuff. What's top of mind for us right now? We're investigating the CL namespacing concern, which I mentioned briefly. We're looking at how best to define a resource model for a repository of common logic texts. We're looking for a good option for a CL reasoner, and this is proving to be challenging, not only from a technology perspective, but also from a licensing perspective, something that's compatible with our objectives of an ecosystem that Michael mentioned. We're building common logic specific tooling. So Cogiware has just released a beta of a CliffAware text editor for Eclipse that Michael's using in his group to help build the Calori content, and that seems to be working okay. We're analyzing the BioPortal architecture to see how they've done things there and get some ideas and maybe see how things are different between what they've done and what Calori needs to be based on the objectives. And we're analyzing the OOR requirements from the Ontologs initiative, the use cases and communique and things like that. From an administrative perspective, we're going to start looking for funding to fund some of this development, and we're looking for project contributors for both content and software. And we're starting to populate the project website. So these are new sites. We're starting to use the wikis, the discussion forums. We're populating the repositories. There's issue trackers, a few issues in there. So we're starting to ramp them up as more managed and transparent open projects. And we're also looking to identify synergies with other groups that can maybe share in some of the workload. So that's about all I have to say.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That sounds like an excellent start on putting all these things together. And I especially like the idea of using the Eclipse license and making sure that you have it all in an open source kind of core framework, which you can use for either commercial or non-commercial use. That sounds like a foundation that a lot of people can build on. And Google Apps have a lot of interesting apps, but it's very nice to see that they're putting those into Eclipse so that when you use them through the Eclipse, you're not using proprietary things that are tailored to any single provider. So I think this sounds like an excellent foundation. And if we can bring all of these tools together under that kind of a framework, we can support research and commercial applications in an open-ended way and tie them in with a lot of other work that's been done in Eclipse, Google Apps, and everything else. So I think this is an excellent start for putting things together.
And for the Eclipse project, the EPL license, and kind of modeling it on the Eclipse Foundation, it's an attempt to try to bring researchers closer to industry as well. So that's why I think supporting commercial additions or extensions is a very important part of the ecosystem.
I completely agree. I worked at IBM for 30 years, and one of the most frustrating things that I found was the total isolation, or almost total isolation, of huge amounts of very valuable research from work that was going on in all kinds of commercial work. That people talk about the problem of artificial intelligence not getting into the mainstream, but when you're isolated from the mainstream, there's no hope. And so there's huge amounts of things, such as Lisp was under development for half a century and never got into the mainstream, largely because their tools were so totally isolated from everything that the commercial people were using. But if we can really make these tools available equally well by researchers and by commercial, that's a very big plus. Now, one problem with Eclipse is that it is a rather large platform that a lot of people in research in universities are loath to get into that because you have a lot of, it's a big step to learn all of that stuff in order to write this one little project for your thesis or something like that. So,
well, the goal of the Samian project would actually be to isolate or encapsulate as much as possible of that, so that people have, you know, if you wanted to write a new reasoning system, you wouldn't have to worry about how you're going to persist it or access it. You just have to understand the interface to that and you get all of that other stuff for free.
That is an excellent approach. So I think that sounds like a very good platform for integrating everything else. And now our last speaker of the day is Adam Pease. And Adam has been developing platforms for ontology and using SUOKIF and with plans to go into extend this into CLIF and integrate everything with everything else. So let me introduce Adam.
Okay. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Great. Okay. So in the short time that I have, I thought the best thing I could do first is to provide a couple of references, including a recent paper that Chris Binsmuller and I did that gives a far more extensive description of Sigma that I can give here. Slide 2. So I wanted to start on slide 2 with just a couple of statements about what I think some of our requirements for an OOR should be, in my opinion. So I think that's really the starting point for actually deciding which of these several tools that we're talking about might actually fit the need. So I think first, and I'm gratified to see that we've got a couple of choices here for repositories that actually are capable of understanding the full semantics of the content, because if we couldn't do that, we might as well just use some kind of document management system. And I'd also say that repositories must support the most expressive content, because otherwise we're stuck with the least common denominator, in which case we might as well just use some RDF tools. So certainly having at least first-order logic plus equality is a necessity, and as I say, I'm glad to see we've got a couple options there. Slide 3. Also, it's great that we've actually got some existing software we can use so that we're not talking about vaporware. In past years, we were talking about plans for things rather than real software that exists right now. And also, I've found in some of our ontolog discussions in past years, it's very easy to make sort of broad, general statements about needs or capabilities, but the devil is always in the details, and I'll say a little bit more about that when it comes to actual inference on very large theories. It's one thing to say you have a first-order logic plus a quality reasoner. It's quite another to make that actually work in practice with a large theory. Slide 4. So functional requirements. I think there was a speaker on our lead-in call last week that talked about this. So one of the functional requirements I take of the OOR is to be able to do some kind of formal consistency checking of content. We've already had some discussion today about problems with model finders actually working in practice, and certainly we found that even if you don't have list constructs, that in practice a large theory such as SUMO and basically any theory that you would use for a sort of practical application project as opposed to a sort of technology project or an education project is going to be too large for a model finder. And so what you have to do is prove small portions of your model consistent and then attempt to integrate them. And that's also extremely hard to do. We've not been successful doing that for SUMO itself. But what you can do is what I call statistical coverage. You have an NP-complete problem for doing FOL proving on any large theory like SUMO. You can't absolutely prove that it's consistent, but what you can do is run with a focus of attention on different axioms. You can run for different periods of time, and the longer you run, the greater your statistical confidence is that you, in fact, have not found a problem. And that no problem exists. And that's exactly what we've done with SUMO over the years. We started out about in 2003 doing some consistency checking with an early version of Vampire, you know, found a lot of problems in the first week and then didn't find any problems thereafter, even running for very long periods of time. However, Vampire has gotten so good just in this past year that thanks to Jeff Sutcliffe at the University of Miami, he's actually found a few more extremely deep and, in one case, quite troublesome inconsistencies that we've since been able to correct. Also an interesting point, while in theory, people make a lot of, give a lot of importance to the notion that you can't really do anything with an inconsistent theory because once you can prove faults, you can prove anything. However, in practice, these inconsistencies, the couple that we found just in this past year, were completely unknown to us through several years of practical work with SUMO and work by many other people as well. So it's also possible for inconsistencies to exist at a very deep level and for you to be able to do completely useful work for many years with your theorem provers being, you know, blithely unconcerned with an as-yet undiscovered very deep inconsistency. Slide 5. So I'm proposing Sigma as one candidate for an open ontology repository. We started the Sigma project about in 2001. Its first release, I believe, was in 2002. Since 2004, it's been hosted on SourceForge and gets about one download a day for the past several years. So it includes browsing, inference, and analysis capability for first-order logic plus equality. Quite recently, thanks to work that Christoph Benzmuller's been doing, we have a higher-order logic capability. Chris's prover, Leo 2, is currently the world's top-performing higher-order logic prover as measured by the yearly CASC competition that Jeff Sutcliffe runs. And Sigma also embeds the world's top-performing theorem provers as measured along various dimensions. And in recent years, we've been participating fairly heavily in those competitions by submitting sumo-based test problems to really drive this competition away, in part, from focusing on small theories with very deep proofs, or a small theory, maybe a dozen axioms, to what we feel is sort of the more practical and broadly applicable case of very large theories, such as sumo, where an individual proof might not be terribly deep, but it needs to find that needle in the haystack of the few dozen axioms necessary to give the answer while looking through thousands of different axioms that, for the most part, are going to be completely irrelevant on any given query. So dramatically different problem, and it's forced a bit of a change in coding and performance on many of the different provers that participate in CASC. So next slide. So Sigma functions, as I mentioned, browsing and display, analysis and debugging, inference, as well as inference used for consistency checking, that sort of statistical coverage of consistency that I mentioned, also mapping, merging, and translation. And most importantly, for the effort at hand, you can load many different ontologies at the same time in Sigma. We do that both for ontology mapping applications, where we may load a big terminological hierarchy created in OWL and try to map it to sumo, as well as the case where we're doing first-order inference on sumo and its domain ontologies, and most of the domain ontologies may not be relevant, so we'll only load the one or two that are needed for our application. So it's very free and very practical in that regard. Next slide. So just a graphical view of the overall Sigma architecture and its functions, roughly paralleling the arrangement of the sort of HTML-based interface that we run, where you start off with a view of all the knowledge bases that are loaded, and then once you've selected the knowledge base, you have a whole set of different options for operations to provide on that knowledge base. Next slide. There's a whole host of different languages we've supported for several years. Obviously, SuoKIF, which I claim is a concrete syntax for Common Logic, although we certainly need to verify that. I think Cameron's work shows that that's probably true, since that's essentially what he's doing. It is a syntactic variant of Genesaret's KIF, as is CLIF, so that's kind of not surprising that it would just be a concrete syntax. Sumo, the ontology that I write, has been coded in SuoKIF, so there's a very large sort of practical corpus there that we use. Also, recently, we've developed a translator for TTTP, which was mentioned earlier, which is the language of the International Theorem Proving Competition that Jeff Sutcliffe runs, and so we needed to do that to get sumo-based problems into the TTTP. And TTTP is really a de facto standard language for the ATP community. It's a very strict first-order logic plus equality, and so this is one of these sort of practical details that I mentioned, that even though we knew which portion portions of Sumo were intended to be first order logic plus equality, actually getting all of that content accepted by practically implemented reasoners required a few tweaks that I don't really have time to go into today, but are in the paper that I referenced. We also have some degree of support for OWL and Prolog, both reading and writing, and getting the support for the remaining sort of 1% of Cliff syntax that isn't already handled, I think should be fairly easy if there's actually interest in my doing that. Next slide. Persistence. So there's a lot of things that could be done with persisting ontologies, but you know, in 10 years of practice writing Sumo and applying it on different projects, we found that the easiest thing is just to treat ontologies as though they were any other kind of code and use CVS for managing them. There's really no need to reinvent version control, and I could see that happening on an ontology repository project. So just wanted to relay my experience there. Next slide. So Sigma was developed to support Sumo. So Sumo is a large modular ontology that started just as an upper ontology with the 11 different modules with the dependency structure indicated here. And next slide. It's since evolved to a much larger system, which I'm still calling Sumo, but is kind of a misnomer since it incorporates both the upper merged ontology as well as a lot of mid-level and lower-level content with the statistics you see here that are a little bit out of date. It's actually quite a bit bigger now. We've also added in the whole Yago ontology, thanks to work that Gerard DeMello and Fabian Sushanek did to merge Yago with Sumo. Yago is basically an extraction of facts from Wikipedia, and there's something like 4 million different facts that are now integrated with Sumo. So there's a large fact base as well as a significant statement of common sense facts and rules about the world. Next slide. It looks like this audience is actually far more sophisticated than I might have feared, and everybody I think here really recognizes the need for not just simple taxonomies such as most people do in OWL, but real ontologies that actually have rules and full formal definitions of concepts. Slide 13, Sigma inference. So in about 2003, we did some work with Andrei Voronkov, the developer of Vampire, which for a long period has been the top performing theorem prover in the world as measured by the CASC competitions. He generated an open source version for us that worked on SuoKIF, and that's been our core prover for a long time. However, once we started participating in the CASC competitions, adding in Sumo-based problems, this drove a very brilliant young student, Christoph Hoder, to create something he calls the Sumo Inference Engine, or SIEM, which is actually a meta-prover that does relevance testing. It sort of takes those small set of possible needles out of the big haystack of Sumo and says these are probably relevant to the query that you're posing. And the sort of speed-up that we actually got from that beyond your conventional first-order prover is, you know, not only many orders of magnitude, but usually made the difference between getting an answer and just going off into infinity and never getting an answer. So a huge practical relevance and I think a big achievement for the theorem proving community on this sorts of problems. So we integrated SIGN into Sigma, so you can use it as a filter on top of any prover. We have sort of a native implementation of it inside Sigma. And we also integrated Jeff Sutcliffe's system on TPTP so that we now have some 40 different reasoning systems. If you have a problem that has some maybe peculiar characteristics or one of the other provers might perform well, you can use any of them, although in general I recommend either Vampire, E, or iProver as the top performing systems on large knowledge bases, with the caveat that for all of them, using the signed relevance filter on top of it. And as I mentioned, we now have the Leo 2 higher order inference system integrated in Sigma as well, although I'd still call it experimental. We've got some pretty exciting results. Next slide, so just a quick view of, for those of you that haven't seen Sigma, it has, I think, a very friendly HTML-based interface that hyperlinks all the terms and axioms together. Sumo has a whole library of images that are linked to the terms, as well as a full set of links that were done to WordNet that were all done one at a time by hand, all 100,000 synsets. So quite a useful resource for linguistics as well. And also that set of linkages has proven very useful in practice for us in doing ontology mapping and merging applications by enabling us to use what is essentially a very large thesaurus for term names to provide candidate matches for us. Next slide, slide 15. We've also done some work creating a sort of simplified browsing view for the people that are more used to a frame-based system like Oliver Protege, so that you can actually take a very complex ontology like Sumo and just sort of look at the taxonomic structure and the frame axioms and not be confused by the full first-order axioms if that's sort of beyond your interest or capabilities.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. This sounds like an excellent collection of useful tools, and it looks like most or all of them could be integrated with the other work that that the other speakers have been discussing. Have you considered the possibility of bringing it in with the work that Cameron has been doing and putting it into the frameworks like Eclipse and others?
Well, yeah, I think Cameron and I discussed at one point the notion of taking his SuoKif to Cliff translator and pulling that into Sigma. At the time, he hadn't decided on licensing. Now he does have an open licensing, so that would be something certainly for us to revisit.
Okay, because it looks like you have a lot of useful tools that could supplement that, and all of these things could be integrated. Now, Pat Hayes had said that he had a conflict that prevented him from speaking, but he might be able to dial in later. Is Pat around?
Pat, yes, he is.
Pat, can you do you have any comments on any of the above and observations?
Stop through, Pat.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I apologize for missing the earlier talks. I'm very impressed, both with what Cameron and Adam have said, that this work is obviously much further ahead than I had realized in terms of presenting these gigantic complex systems. I had a few sort of minor critical carping remarks about some of the things that were said in the talks, but I think I won't bother. I have a couple of questions, though. For Adam, my question is about higher order. As you probably know, Adam Kadish is, has been described as syntactically higher order and semantically first order, in that it allows quantification into the relation and function positions, but it doesn't have higher order inference principles to back that up. It's deliberately first order. Do you make the distinction syntactically or semantically? In other words, if you talk about higher order theorem prover, do you mean something that can really handle lambda conversion and so forth, or something analogous?
Leo 2 is a true higher order prover that handles lambda expressions and so forth.
Okay. Gee. Wow, I'm impressed.
And so we've actually used it with practical proving on Sumo, so it's also not just for, sort of toy higher order problems, but in connection with Sign, you can do real higher order proofs on Sumo.
What interests me, actually, I mean, it's probably something that you and I should take offline, because I think we could spend weeks on it, but I'm intrigued that you find genuine applications for real higher order reasoning on a Sumo style knowledge base. I mean, but you're telling me you do, which is interesting to me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's
sort of. Go ahead.
Yeah, to me that's not a surprise. I mean, I think in fact that a lot of applications that the whole theorem proving community does has sort of been biased on what we can do. And so you see that a lot with OWL, that you get these large OWL ontologies that don't have things like between in them, because it's simply too hard to do when you only have binary relations. And the same thing holds true for higher order, that how can you imagine a sort of practical problem that, you know, doesn't need some statement of belief or knowledge in it. And those are necessarily higher order things. We only haven't been doing them because we haven't been able to do them.
Well, yes, but a lot of those things can still be handled within the common logic framework, because you don't really require that huge hierarchy of all possible orders of infinity just in order to reason with about a variable that ranges over the set of relations you're talking about.
Well, we should talk specifics about that.
Yeah, those are issues.
Yeah,
that
right. I think that offline.
Yeah, my suspicion is that those theorem provers really are doing something that is within the common logic semantic framework. But we'll still have to discuss this in detail. Any other questions?
Very interesting.
And,
my other question. Yeah, my other question was actually for Cameron. And it's far more mundane, really, in a sense. I'm just intrigued as to the decision to go with URNs. I would have thought that, you know, I think that the URL-URN distinction got kind of buried into IRIs and IURIs, and the more recent notion is internationalized user identifiers, and I think the IRI specs more or less cover the URNs. Are URNs still widely used? I mean, I'm worried about you being locked into like 8-track tapes or something, that kind of old technology.
Actually, this is something that we started to look at maybe a couple of weeks ago. Going through the various discussion lists on the W3C and that, it seems to be a never-ending debate over URLs and URIs. One of the things that we want to avoid with the URL, or URI, whatever they're calling it these days, is the idea of locking into a specific node on the web. You want to make sure that, yeah.
I mean, the W3C are very, very, at least the W3C kind of official line, is very strongly of the opinion that an IRI, a URI, certainly an IRI, is not a specific location, right? That's considered to be a kind of design error equipment identification. So I think they've already have this fight for you. You know, you could join the latest club and still be doing the right thing.
Well, where they've ended up though is that so the way I read it was that URIs still have the domain name within them, right? So it looks like a URL. Well, that domain name is, when you look at it from an open ontology perspective, that domain name is registered with, say, some company or some affiliation somewhere, right?
With the owner,
right? Yeah, the owner, exactly. There is an owner. Whereas with the URN, the thing I liked about it was the fact that it was just a registered name, and you can associate that. But, you know, Michael and I had talked about maybe registering a domain name, but then who owns the domain name and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, if that really bothers you, then you could go for Perls, for example, which have a kind of automatic mechanism for creating domains.
Right. Yes, and
okay. But if you've looked at it and made your decision, then I don't want to start an argument here. I just I was struck that seeing
I haven't made the decision, and that's one of the reasons why I put it on the slide. This is something that we're just kind of mulling about now. So there is no definitive decision to go that way. So I'll look at the IRI stuff, actually, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I just get the sense that our URNs were sort of, like, really, like, yesterday's technology, and no one was... See how active it is. If no one's registered a URN in the last 10 years, I would think seriously about doing something else.
There's only a few URNs registered, actually, so you have a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, what about other comments and questions? Anybody else?
We had a situation with the chat board for a little bit, so let's start from scratch again. There were a couple of hands before, so if people could sort of press the hand button again, we will cue everyone up.
Pat Cassidy had a question from way back. Maybe Pat could come in.
Okay. The question is directed toward the people who are working with the HETs and Samian systems for translating ontologies into each other. My feeling, or very strongly held, and I think I have good reasons for it, is that accurate interoperability, if you can translate ontologies in a meaningful way, cannot be done unless there is some basic set of commonly agreed upon, I call them primitive elements, call them what you want, basic elements, ontology elements that are used by everybody with an agreed upon meaning. Without an agreed upon meaning, that you can do translations and they're dependent upon guessing that the same term means the same thing in different ontologies, which at best, under the most favorable circumstances, you might get 90%, and if you have 90% accuracy in meaning reuse, you do a 5-step inference and you have maybe a 60% chance that you're going to arrive at the same conclusion, and most useful things go a hell of a lot more than 5 steps, and it's virtually impossible to get identical or even close to identical inferences unless you have a common basis. So I presume this has been thought about, and the question I had was, particularly to John Bateman here, has any kind of movement been done towards agreeing upon a common ontology? I know there's been a tremendous amount of debate in that in the past, and yet I think the problem is, and people have gotten discouraged, and I think the discouragement primarily comes from the fact that simply hasn't been any money for this effort. If you had money for it, it would not be that difficult to do to get a group together to come to an agreement. Nevertheless, even without the money, the question is whether anybody is discussing this and what's being done about trying to get some kind of agreement on a common basic on.
Well, I noticed that Pat Hayes has his hand up. Pat, do you have any comments on this question or other issues?
No, sorry, I was going to raise a completely separate issue, so that's wrong with
okay,
this order.
That's
the main question there. I've discussed my concern with foundation ontologies for quite a while, and then there's no time here to review that. I'm just wondering whether these people who are working on translation are still thinking about or just have completely given up on the notion of having a common ontology.
Does anybody have any thoughts on common ontology, pro or con?
Well, yeah, I got some thoughts, actually. This is Pat. I think it's a very interesting question, really, as to exactly why we all draw a line between the logic on the one hand and the ontology on the other. And, you know, we treat them completely differently. You know, the logics are almost semantics, and they're thoroughly understood and textbooks about them, and you know, vast amounts of effort are devoted to looking at tiny differences between them and so forth. And then the ontologies are just, well, it's up to you to write. And I guess I'm sort of a little speech on backing up half the point of the way. Is that, you know, to some extent you could just say, well, the logics are, you know, first of all, logic is the ontology of and or not and for all. And there's a lot of other words in English. Maybe same as for if you put in quality, logic with equality. But, you know, I wonder how many more English words one could sort of absorb into the core and say, okay, those we give a fixed meaning to now. I think Pat wants to sort of put in, you know, based on just what he just said, but in his previous writings and debates and so forth, he wants to put in, you know, the best part of the long ones, basically, in the dictionary. But there may be some compromise position. So maybe someone could come up with like 4 more English words that we can all agree on putting into the basic machinery. But just random thought here.
Well, the most common words that people use that have a fixed meaning is this huge number of words that in all the standards, all the units of measure and standards, for example, the names of the days of the week and the months and the
yes.
measurements, those are a huge number of words that everybody can assume we'll have in there.
I agree, John, up to a point. I completely agree with Pat's point that if we could agree on even another half dozen or a dozen words beyond the logical primitives that have actually well understood and fixed meaning, that would be definite progress. And he's right. I do think that we need something of the order of 2,000, at least 2,000 concepts
to represent the vocabulary that people will really need to translate pronunciations to each other.
Now, the words like time are very common, but you look at the number of ontologies for time, if you really try to get to the deeper idea, there's no commonality at all in different theories, but everybody agrees on one thing, and that is that you do have words like before and after. And no matter what your ontology is, you can represent before and after. And Caesar gets into a huge number of philosophical issues. And I noticed that John Bateman had his hands up here on the queue. John, do you have some comments on this?
Yeah, can you hear me now? I was trying to interrupt before, but didn't get in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, John.
Okay. Then I just put a note on the chat board, and this is the answer to Pat Cassidy's original point, saying, is anybody still thinking about this? I'd say we've moved on a little bit from there in that by working on this strong modularity and breaking things down into theories which are more handleable than going out of control, then we have been working on the formal connection of these without necessarily having unified agreement which covers all of these different modules. And for that, on the chat board, I'd refer you to work by Till and Oliver Kutz and Emmanuel Norman. They're looking at shapes of alignment and a way to bring together different theories using various formal techniques. So I'd say that one of, again, broken down the problem into much smaller steps, which are more formally handleable, and I think that will be the way to go. So you don't have to necessarily get this big agreement up there.
I have a comment directed to that, too, and this also applies to the Calora project, that if you have these small theories and you want different, you have different ontology A, ontology B, and they reuse some of these small modular theories, which is good. But the question still remains as to whether these two ontologies, larger ontologies that are using as components on smaller modular ontologies, whether these can transfer information and have it accurately understood. The problem is that with these small modular ontologies, the number of actual models that are consistent with these small theories in the ontologies may be quite large. And in any case, there's no guarantee that two larger ontologies that reuse smaller ontologies will actually interpret the same model. It may be logically consistent, but with other elements in their ontology, when it interacts with other elements in a larger ontology, it may be interpreted in quite different ways. There is just no guarantee that you're going to have consistency, even if you use these modular ontologies. I can't visualize it.
Yes, let me suggest that, you know, we better not start this debate here a little bit.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, that's my question. And so, John's answered by saying no, they're going the modular way, and they're not looking for a large. So that is the answer. Thank you.
Right. Okay. I noticed that comments on the written form by both Adam Pease and John Bateman say that these are debates we're not going to solve here. Are there any other questions? I think Michael Gringer has his hand up.
No, I guess we'll save this.
It's a queue. Yeah, there's a queue.
Well, I think
we'll save this for another telecon.
Okay. John Bateman, do you have a comment?
I made it already.
Okay. That's your written one, which I just read. Okay. Anybody else have further comments and questions?
Actually, I do. Again, this is Pat. I go back to my hand is still up for my original. So I, having been late to this call, I now have to be early off it, unfortunately, for other reasons. I wanted to say this before I left. There may be an effort in the near future to write at least a corrected version, and hopefully maybe slightly updated version of the ETL reference method. If there is, if I'm involved in it, both of which are not entirely certain yet, then I would like to sort of put out a general call, especially to folk, you know, who are implementing systems and regulatory feedback, to provide as much feedback as possible about things that are problematic in the current spec, or awkward, or difficult, or ambiguous, and also any things that they, as a result of their experiences, would like to see in a revised, I don't mean a totally rewritten, but in a adapted, modified, extended, whatever version of the spec, if things are missing. I know there's been some discussion on the CL mailing list, Dolby from Cameron, but spread the word. If anybody's got experience with or even thought hard about deploying CL in the real world and has noticed some problems with it, and especially any gaps in it, please put them on the mailing list or send them to me. I guess that's just, I just want to say that to the, for the audience. Well,
just to read, John Bateman has a comment there. It says, Pat, before you go, can we have agreement on the module semantics? We're waiting on this to finalize the data treatment of the module. And then Cameron has a comment. Says, I have a pile of comments regarding a revised spec, and he wants to start a dialogue. I suggest that we get this going on the Common Logic mailing list.
Absolutely.
These are
absolutely
issues that we really have to get in.
Yeah, absolutely. That, by all means, let's do that on the Common Logic mailing list. I put a date here because it's a potentially a broad audience. I expected Cameron to have a whole pile of them. The module semantics, there is still an open issue regard to an absolutely peculiar but theoretically fascinating corner case involving vacuous quantification into a module. We have actually got that theoretically worked out, but we haven't written it up yet. Honest to God, I don't think we've got a person who needs to worry about it. I don't think this case is ever going to arise in actual practice anywhere, but it's theoretically very fascinating.
Okay. Just one question from Anonymous. Where is the CL mailing list? The answer is go to cl.tamu, as in Texas A&M University, cl.tamu.edu.
Or just Google Common Logic, and there's a very good chance that it'll get people the other first page hits, maybe the first hit.
Right.
That's the module.
Okay, I have to go, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for letting me interrupt you all. So,
okay, any other questions, comments? Oh, I noticed that John Bateman is still on the queue. John, do you have anything further to say?
Well, I will, because from last time. I just wanted to just, I think Pat is gone, but we really do need a decision on the module in order to use the information in Colore. We're not using the import information now, not because it isn't ready or can't. We need the semantics in order to know what these things mean.
Okay.
So it's more than something which is going to just be a theoretical issue. We need them to come down on one side of the line or the other and say how they would like it to be. And we're
please send that note to the CL mailing list. That's very important there. And Cameron, you're on the queue. Anything further?
Just that maybe this isn't the place, but I'll just plant the seed. In terms of process on the Common Logic list, I've submitted a number of these issues, and they seem to kind of get lost in antiquity. So, and I don't think we have a technical editor for ISO, so we need to straighten out some things
we
there.
Definitely
before we
need more administrative system for the CL list. I think that's definitely important.
So I'd really encourage that we start with that discussion before we start going off on, you know, talking about all the issues.
Let's get that issue on the CL list. And then Peter has a comment here, too.
Yes. I thank all the presenters for their great talk. I mean, it's evidently a lot of work and a lot of work that are done independently. So please, I mean, if the whole group could come and come to the ongoing OOR team meeting, and let's try to, I mean, of course, please work offline among each other, but do come to the OOR meetings and give us updates regularly. I mean, we don't need that often. It's only once every 2 weeks when we don't have other events like this. So do come to the meeting so that we keep getting work maybe coordinated and collaboratively done, if possible.
Okay. Well, thank you for everybody, and let's keep in touch on Ontolog Forum and on Common Logic mailing list. Anybody who's interested in the CL list, just go to http://cl.tamu.edu, and that will get you there.
Yeah, Ali Hashemi has posted the info link to where people can subscribe and get to the archives of everything.
Okay, John Aitman, are you still in the queue? Is still a question?
No, it's still the same thing. I've been there all the time.
Yeah, well, you have to put that on the Common Logic email list and highlight it so that everybody knows this is a critical topic. Okay. I think that's basically it, and we're well over time. Bye.
Thank you, Dr. Shalom. So, bye-bye. Dr. Scorbito. Bye-bye.
Okay, great. Thanks.